You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann, and I'm going to finish the story I started last week. How many billionaires are there anyway? And he is interviewing now Carrie Dolan, who's in charge of building the list of Forbes lists of billionaires. And Ms. Dolan says the easiest sort of billionaire for Dolan to handle is one whose wealth derives from his ownership stake in a publicly traded company, probably one he founded, though possibly one he inherited. Anyone who owns more than 5% of a company's shares must disclose that fact along with the exact number of shares they hold. But once you've passed what's discoverable in the public markets, these figures are pretty much just a combination of reporting and educated guess. Many billionaires, for example, have equity in companies that haven't yet and may never make an IPO, at least not at their current valuations. If they do, they may make even more. Many own stakes in regular old privately held companies that are worth billions, selling shoes, New Balance, or hardware, Menards, or candy, Mars. All of these have created billionaires. To arrive at a value for these firms, Forbes compares them to similar companies that are publicly traded. All alleged billionaires are given an opportunity to comment on the magazine's claims. Some share more detailed information. Most don't. 2012, Bloomberg started a billionaires index of its own by hiring reporters from Forbes. It now covers the top 500 in the world and updates every day. Forbes, too, has a live ranking of billionaires that updates with the markets, and just a quick glance at the top 10 shows considerable differences in the estimates. Bloomberg agrees that Musk is now the wealthiest man on the planet, for example, but estimates his net worth to be about $15 billion, lower than Forbes does. By the number 7 spot, the rankings diverge, and Bloomberg places Sergey Brin, $119 billion, where Forbes has Larry Ellison, $115.7 billion. Some differences between the Forbes and Bloomberg lists are simply products of different reporting and different methodologies. Bloomberg's methodology is considerably more transparent than Forbes's, but its published list is 1/5 the size of Forbes' list for now, and its newsroom much bigger. For each of the 500 billionaires, Bloomberg offers a 1-to-5-star ranking based on its confidence in the estimate, with those who cooperate with the reporting process and whose assets are held mostly in publicly traded companies getting 5 stars. Only a handful have the honor, and those whose assets are hidden or illiquid scoring lower. And yet, for all its precision, Bloomberg's list has one intentional flaw. It doesn't contain Michael Bloomberg, the founder and majority owner of Bloomberg LP, a distinction that has made him a billionaire many times over, some 82 times to be exact, at least according to the latest numbers from Forbes. Today, Bloomberg's wealth desk is run by an Englishman named Pierre Polden, who oversees more than 25 reporters and editors, though the team often taps into the organization's broader newsroom of 2,700. Polden, like Dolan, has noticed over the years that fewer and fewer billionaires want to be discovered. In fact, when unknowns do announce themselves to the press as billionaires, Polden and his team regard their claims with great caution. Most of the time now, the type of fortune that we're trying to find, they don't really want you there, he says. Polden's desk has turned up some enormous hidden fortunes in recent years. They dug into Leo Koguan, a Singaporean businessman, after he went on Twitter one day and claimed that he was the third biggest shareholder in Tesla. And then he went dark, Polden says. He eventually resurfaced, and they were able to confirm his holdings in what Paulden calls a global effort, both by looking at his financial records and by talking to his business associates. Similarly, Bloomberg broke the news that Changpeng Zhao, the chief executive of the crypto exchange Binance, was much richer than anyone knew. He was the 11th richest person on the planet. When they published the story, they estimated his fortune to be $96 billion, noting that it was most likely higher. They didn't even include any of his personal crypto holdings in the figure. Both Bloomberg and Forbes consider themselves conservative in their estimates of billionaire wealth. And in fact, there exists yet another billionaire census done by a research company called WealthX that is considerably less so. In 2021, it counted 927 billionaires in the United States, some 203 more than Forbes did. It doesn't name any of them. Perhaps they're right about these 203 unnamed billionaires. Perhaps not. It's frustrating to not know, to know you can never know for sure. But even more frustrating to know that knowing wouldn't change a thing about it. Last summer, I was wandering around the neighborhood where I grew up in San Francisco, one substantially changed over the last decade, like every corner of that city, by the enormous fortunes generated in Silicon Valley. San Francisco is now home to 81 billionaires, at least according to WealthX. That's almost 2 per square mile, or about 1 for every 10,000 residents, the highest concentration in the world. As I was walking, I came across a homemade sign hung in the window of an old Edwardian. It read, "No billionaires. 999,999,999.99 is enough already." The sentiment was comically San Franciscan, stridently in line with contemporary liberal values, and at the same time, openly tolerant of extreme inequality. Why would it be okay for someone to have 999 million and not a billion? What really happens when that last penny pushes them over the line? It can feel as if we live in an era defined by rage at billionaires, but most Americans actually don't have much appetite to eat the rich. We did, quite recently, elect a billionaire to the presidency. In January 2020, and then again in July of last year, Pew surveyed Americans to see if they thought billionaires were good for the country, bad for the country, or neither. In 2020, 58% of respondents said they were neither. A year and a half into the pandemic, the number had barely budged. It dropped to 55% within the margin of error. Some 29% think they're bad. 15% think they're good. It's not exactly October 1917 out there. Still, one core cohort stood out, 18 to 29-year-olds. Fully 50% of them believe billionaires are bad for the country. And is it any surprise? This is a generation that has grown up paddling in the chop of the economy that produced all this disordered wealth, working, or failing to find work, in industries that have been financially engineered into ruin by the fleece vest guys of Midtown, or upended by software that made some nerd so rich his grandchildren's grandchildren will live like princelings, and either way paying obscene rents to millionaire landlords who were smart enough to be born 20 years before them. Billionaires are, from this perspective, the purest distillation of the brutality and stupidity of arranging a society this way. As the ultra-wealthy have multiplied, some Americans have drifted toward a sort of billionaire Gnosticism, a sense that we live in a fallen world run by a demonic group of plutocrats. On the right, you have the whole unseemly George Soros thing, in which one man is imagined to be the devious puppet master behind everything from Central American migrant caravans to the George Floyd protests. Though not personally a billionaire, Klaus Schwab, the head of the World Economic Forum at Davos, has been reimagined as a sort of Bond villain, serving their interests, plotting to make you live on cricket meat as part of something called the Great Reset. On the left, the disturbing revelations about Jeffrey Epstein and his connections to several billionaires have led to fevered speculation about the sources of his wealth and the circumstances surrounding his pre-trial suicide. But you don't need to think of any individual billionaire as evil to find the sheer concentration of power they have disturbing. On the contrary, one of the scariest things about our billionaires is that they're really just people with all the frailty that entails. Think about Musk's desperate outing as an SNL host, or Gates's lame efforts at dating in middle age, Bezos's corny sexting, Zuckerberg's uncanny approximation of normal behavior, Tom Steyer's and Bloomberg's doomed presidential campaigns, both in the same cycle, both to unseat another billionaire who lost anyway. There really are some things money can't buy, and our billionaires demonstrate this just as often as they prove the converse. Of course, there's also a lot of money, a lot that money can buy. Not just yachts and Picassos, but lawyers, politicians, silence. You can finance a lawsuit against a website you don't like and make it disappear. You can commission a yacht so big that it can't get to sea unless you disassemble a bridge. You can offer to cover the cost of bridge disassembly. You can fund a libertarian uprising against the sitting president and derail his agenda. You can launch a car into space. There's a very good reason the genie forbids wishing for unlimited wishes. I witnessed the dizzying effects of this caprice firsthand about a decade ago. I was working at a scenery restaurant in Manhattan where an ultra-wealthy customer came in twice in the span of about a month. I was told at the time that he was a billionaire, though I can't say for sure whether he really was. He certainly seemed like it. On the first occasion, he spent something like $10,000 on wine, tipping 20% on top of that, adding some $2,000 to the tip pool. Each waiter made $600 that night. It nearly covered my rent for the month. Then, not long after, he sat down in one of my banquettes. This caused a small flurry of action. The maitre d' let me know who he was, and the sommelier urged me to send him over as soon as he expressed any curiosity about wine. I went over and told him and his companion about the night's specials and took their order. I'll never forget what he asked for. The burger. Anything to drink? I asked, still anticipating victory. Yes, he said, a glass of the Cabernet. I think he spent about $100 that night, as was his right, because in addition to being insanely wealthy, he was also just some guy, and sometimes all the guy wants is a cheeseburger and a drink. The issue with billionaires is not that they're sociopaths, though certainly some are. It's that their power comes with no accountability. They dwell, or don't dwell, as is often the case, above the clouds. In super tall skyscrapers, they fly to private islands on private jets and do God knows what there. Their yachts remind us that no matter what the paperwork says, they're citizens of no nation, that if we try to fix them in place, they can just go elsewhere. They become enamored of certain ideas, fixing African agriculture, resurrecting von Mises and Hayek, terraforming Mars, being the president, and can spend nearly unlimited sums in the pursuit of making them a reality. Even if they fail at any or all of it, they will remain billionaires, and there's not much you can do about it. They're not elected to the role, so you can't vote them out of it. They didn't become billionaires by cashing paychecks, so there's no one you can harass into firing them. They didn't break the law to make $1 billion, at least usually not, so you can't drop a dime on them. They have more money than God, as the saying goes, so even he is of no use. And until something changes, we'll live in a nation that is substantially warped by the gravity of their fortunes. The author of the article, Will Staley, is a story editor for the magazine. And now I'll read another featured article. AI, artificial intelligence, is mastering language. Should we trust what it says? OpenAI's GPT-3 and other neural nets can now write original prose with mind-boggling fluency, a development that could have profound implications for the future. This is a story by Stephen Johnson. You're sitting in a comfortable chair by the fire on a cold winter's night. Perhaps you have a mug of tea in hand, perhaps something stronger. You open a magazine to an article you've been meaning to read. The title suggested a story about a promising, but also potentially dangerous, new technology on the cusp of becoming mainstream. And after reading only a few sentences, you find yourself pulled into the story. A revolution is coming in machine intelligence, the author argues, and we need, as a society, to get better at anticipating its consequences. But then the strangest thing happens. You notice that the writer has, seemingly deliberately, omitted the very last word of the first. The missing word jumps into your consciousness almost unbidden. The very last word of the first paragraph. There's no sense of an internal search query in your mind. The word paragraph just pops out. It might seem like second nature, this filling in the blank exercise, but doing it makes you think of the embedded layers of knowledge behind the thought. You need a command of the spelling and syntactic patterns of English. You need to understand not just the dictionary definitions of words, but also the ways they relate to one another. You have to be familiar enough with the high standards of magazine publishing to assume that the missing word is not just a typo, and that editors are generally loath to omit key words in published pieces unless the author is trying to be clever. Perhaps trying to use the missing word to make a point about your cleverness. How swiftly a human speaker of English can conjure just the right word. Before you can pursue that idea any further, you're back into the article, where you find the author has taken you to a building complex in suburban Iowa. Inside one of the buildings lies a wonder of modern technology. 285,000 CPU cores yoked together into one giant supercomputer powered by solar arrays and cooled by industrial fans. The machine never sleeps. Every second of every day, they churn through innumerable calculations using state-of-the-art techniques and machine intelligence that go by names like stochastic gradient descent and convolutional neural networks. The whole system is believed to be one of the most powerful supercomputers on the planet. And what, you may ask, is this computational dynamo doing with all these prodigious resources? Mostly, it's playing a kind of game over and over again, billions of times a second. And the game is called, guess what the missing word is? The supercomputer complex in Iowa is running a program created by OpenAI, an organization established in late 2015 by a handful of Silicon Valley luminaries, including Elon Musk, Greg Brockman, who until recently had been chief technology officer of the e-payment juggernaut Stripe, and Sam Altman, at the time the president of the startup incubator Y Combinator. In its first few years, as it built up its programming brain trust, OpenAI's technical achievements were mostly overshadowed by the star power of its founders. But that changed in summer 2020 when OpenAI began offering limited access to a new program called Generative Pre-trained Transformer 3, colloquially referred to as GPT-3. Generative Pre-trained Transformer 3. Though the platform was initially available to only a small handful of developers, examples of GPT-3's uncanny prowess with language and at least the illusion of cognition began to circulate across the web and through social media. Siri and Alexa had popularized the experience of conversing with machines, but this was on the next level, approaching a fluency that resembled creations from science. Approaching a fluency that resembled creations from science fiction like HAL 9000 from 2001, a computer program that can answer open-ended complex questions in perfectly composed sentences. As a field, artificial intelligence is currently fragmented among a number of different approaches targeting different kinds of problems. Some systems are optimized for problems that involve moving through physical space, as in self-driving cars or robotics. Others categorize photos for you, identifying familiar faces or pets or vacation activities. Some forms of AI, like AlphaFold, a project of the Alphabet, formerly Google, subsidiary DeepMind, are starting to tackle complex scientific problems, like predicting the structure of proteins, which is central to drug design and discovery. Many of these experiments share an underlying approach known as deep learning, in which a neural net, vaguely modeled after the structure of the human brain, learns to identify patterns or solve problems through endlessly repeated cycles of trial and error, strengthening neural connections and weakening others through a process known as training. The depth of deep learning refers to multiple layers of artificial neurons in the neural net, layers that correspond to higher and higher levels of abstraction. In a vision-based model, for instance, a layer of neurons might detect vertical lines, which would then feed into a layer detecting edges of physical structures, which would then report to a layer that identified houses as opposed to apartment buildings. GPT-3 belongs to a category of deep learning known as a large language model, a complex neural net that has been trained on a titanic data set of text. In GPT-3's case, roughly 700 gigabytes of data drawn from across the web, including Wikipedia, supplemented with a large collection of text from digitized books. GPT-3 is the most celebrated of the large language models and the most publicly available. But Google, Meta, formerly known as Facebook, and DeepMind have all developed their own LLMs in recent years. Advances in computational power and new mathematical techniques have enabled LLMs of GPT-3's vintage to ingest far larger data sets than their predecessors and employ much deeper layers of artificial neurons for their training. Chances are you have already interacted with a large language model if you've ever used an application like Gmail that includes an auto-complete feature gently prompting you with the word attend after you type the sentence, "Sadly, I won't be able to." But autocomplete is only the most rudimentary expression of what software like GPT-3 is capable of. Turns out that with enough training data and sufficiently deep neural nets, large language models can display remarkable skill if you ask them not just to fill in the missing word, but also to continue on writing whole paragraphs in the style of the initial prompt. For example, when I gave GPT-3 the prompt, in 1958, Frank Rosenblatt introduced the perceptron, an early version of a neural net that could only detect the location of a square on a printed card. 50 years later, neural nets are capable of... The software dutifully completed the thought and then continued on, picking up on the historical framing of the initial text. Detecting and classifying faces, finding patterns in data, and emulating the human brain. When the neural net matured in academia, it also found its way into the tech industry. In the late 1980s and early 90s, neural nets were used in speech recognition and character recognition applications. The growth in computing power and the ability to collect larger data sets allowed other neural net applications to emerge. Since GPT-3's release, the internet has been awash with examples of the software's eerie facility with language, along with its blind spots and foibles and other more sinister tendencies. GPT-3 has been trained to write Hollywood scripts and compose nonfiction in the style of Gay Talese's new journalism classic, Frank Sinatra Has a Cold. You can employ GPT-3 as a simulated dungeon master, conducting elaborate text-based adventures through worlds that are invented on the fly by the neural net. Others have fed the software prompts that generate patently offensive or delusional responses, showcasing the limitations of the model and its potential for harm if adopted widely in its current state. So far, the experiments with large language models have been mostly that, experiments probing the model for signs of true intelligence, exploring its creative uses, exposing its biases. But the ultimate commercial potential is enormous. If the existing trajectory continues, software like GPT-3 could revolutionize how we search for information in the next few years. Today, if you have a complicated question about something, how to set up your home theater system, say, or what the options are for creating a 529 education fund for your children, you most likely type a few keywords into Google and then scan through a list of links or suggested videos on YouTube, skimming through everything to get to the exact information you seek. Needless to say, you wouldn't even think of asking Siri to walk you through something this complex. But if the GPT-3 true believers are correct, in the near future, you'll just ask an LLM the question and get the answer fed back to you cogently and accurately. Customer service could be utterly transformed. Any company with a product that currently requires a human tech support team might be able to train an LLM to replace them. And those jobs might not be the only ones lost. For decades now, prognosticators have worried about the threat that AI and robotics pose to assembly line workers. But GPT-3's recent track record suggests that other, more elite professions may be ripe for disruption. A few months after GPT-3 went online, the OpenAI team discovered that the neural net had developed surprisingly effective skills at writing computer software, even though the training data had not deliberately included examples of code. It turned out that the web is filled with countless pages that include examples of computer programming, accompanied by descriptions of what the code is designed to do. From those elemental clues, GPT-3 effectively taught itself how to program. OpenAI refined those embryonic coding skills with more targeted training and now offers an interface called Codex that generates structured code in a dozen programming languages in response to natural language instructions. Same principle applies to other fields that involve highly structured documents. For instance, even without the kind of targeted training that OpenAI employed to create Codex, GPT-3 can already generate sophisticated legal documents like licensing agreements or leases. But as GPT-3's fluency has dazzled many observers, The large language model approach has also attracted significant criticism over the last few years. Some skeptics argue that the software is capable only of blind mimicry, that it's imitating the synaptic patterns of human language, but is incapable of generating its own ideas or making complex decisions, a fundamental limitation that will keep the LLM approach from ever maturing into anything resembling human intelligence. For these critics, GPT-3 is just the latest shiny object in a long history of AI hype, channeling research dollars and attention into what will ultimately prove to be a dead end, keeping other promising approaches from maturing. Other critics believe that the software like GPT-3 will forever remain compromised by the biases, propaganda, and misinformation in the data it has been trained on, meaning that using it for anything more than parlor tricks will always be irresponsible. Wherever you land in this debate, the pace of recent improvement in large language models makes it hard to imagine that they won't be deployed commercially in the coming years. And that raises the question of exactly how they, and for that matter, the other headlong advances of AI, should be unleashed on the world. In the rise of Facebook and Google, we've seen how dominance and a new realm of technology can quickly lead to astonishing power over society. And AI threatens to be even more transformative than social media in its ultimate effects. What is the right kind of organization to build and own something of such scale and ambition, with such promise and such potential for abuse? Or should we be building it at all? OpenAI's origins date to July 2015, when a small group of tech world luminaries gathered for a private dinner at the Rosewood Hotel on Sand Hill Road, the symbolic heart of Silicon Valley. The dinner took place amid two recent developments in the technology world, one positive and one more troubling. On the one hand, radical advances in computational power and some new breakthroughs in the design of neural nets had created a palpable sense of excitement in the field of machine learning. There was a sense that the long AI winter, the decades in which the field failed to live up to its early hype, was finally beginning to thaw. A group at the University of Toronto had trained a program called AlexNet to identify classes of objects in photographs, dogs, castles, tractors, tables, with a level of accuracy far higher than any neural network had previously achieved. Google quickly swooped in to hire the AlexNet creators while simultaneously acquiring DeepMind and starting an initiative of its own called Google Brain. The mainstream adoption of intelligent assistants like Siri demonstrated that even scripted agents could be breakout consumer hits. But during the same stretch of time, a seismic shift in public attitudes toward big tech was underway, with once popular companies like Google or Facebook being criticized for their near monopoly powers, their amplifying of conspiracy theories, and their inexorable siphoning of our attention toward algorithmic feeds. Long-term fears about the dangers of artificial intelligence were appearing in op-ed pages and on the TED stage. Nick Bostrom of Oxford University published his book, Superintelligence, introducing a range of scenarios whereby advanced AI might deviate from humanity's interests with potentially disastrous consequences. In late 2014, Stephen Hawking announced to the BBC that, quote, the development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race. It seemed as if the cycle of corporate consolidation that characterized the social media age was already happening with AI, only this time around, the algorithms might not just sow polarization or sell our attention to the highest bidder, they might end up destroying humanity itself. And once again, all the evidence suggested that this power was going to be controlled by a few Silicon Valley mega corporations. The agenda for the dinner on Sand Hill Road that night was nothing if not ambitious. Figuring out the best way to steer AI research toward the most positive outcome possible, avoiding both the short-term negative consequences that bedeviled the Web 2.0 era and the long-term existential threats. From that dinner, a new idea began to take shape, one that would soon become a full-time obsession for Sam Altman of Y Combinator and Greg Brockman, who recently had left Stripe. Interestingly, the idea was not so much technological as it was organizational. If AI was going to be unleashed on the world in a safe and beneficial way, it was going to require innovation on the level of governance and incentives and stakeholder involvement. The technical path to what the field calls artificial general intelligence, or AGI, was not yet clear to the group, but the troubling forecast from Bostrom and Hawking convinced them that the achievement of human-like intelligence by AIs would consolidate an astonishing amount of power and moral burden in whoever eventually managed to invent and control them. In December 2015, the group announced the formation of a new entity called OpenAI. Altman had signed on to be chief executive of the enterprise, with Brockman overseeing the technology. Another attendee at the dinner, the AlexNet co-creator Ilya Sutskever, had been recruited from Google to be head of research. Elon Musk, who was also president at the dinner, joined the board of directors but left in 2018. In a blog post, Brockman and Sutskever laid out the scope of their ambition. OpenAI is a nonprofit artificial intelligence research company, they wrote. Our goal is to advance digital intelligence in a way that is most likely to benefit humanity as a whole, unconstrained by a need to generate financial return. And they added, we believe AI should be an extension of individual human wills and in the spirit of liberty as broadly and evenly distributed as possible. The OpenAI founders would release a public charter 3 years later, spelling out the core principles behind the new organization. The document was easily interpreted as a not-so-subtle dig at Google's "Don't Be Evil" slogan from its early days, an acknowledgement that maximizing the social benefits and minimizing the harms of new technology was not always that simple a calculation. While Google and Facebook had reached global domination through closed-source algorithms and proprietary networks, the OpenAI founders promised to go in the other direction, sharing new research and code freely with the world. While the OpenAI charter may have been less cavalier than "Don't Be Evil," it took several years for the organization to work out in practice how to honor its tenets. Today, roughly a fifth of the organization is focused full-time on what it calls safety and alignment, that is, aligning the technology with humanity's interests, reviewing ways in which the software is being used by outside developers, creating new tools to reduce the risk of toxic speech or misinformation. OpenAI's software license explicitly forbids anyone to use their tools to, quote, determine eligibility for credit, employment, housing, or similar essential services, which have been some of the most controversial aspects of AI to date. Other banned uses include payday lending, spam generation, gambling, and promoting pseudo-pharmaceuticals. No doubt haunted by Facebook's involvement in Brexit and the Trump election, OpenAI also blocks any use of its software to influence the political process or to be used for campaigning purposes. One crucial aspect of the original charter didn't last long, though. We started as a nonprofit, Brockman says. There was no question about that. That wasn't something that we debated. But the founders soon realized that creating a neural net complex enough to have a shot at reaching artificial general intelligence would require prodigious resources, enormous compute cycles and huge data sets, not to mention the expense of hiring leading experts in the field. OpenAI could stay on the sidelines of AI research, publishing papers, releasing small-scale experiments, organizing conferences, and cede the actual work of building intelligent software to the tech giants who could afford it, betraying the original principles of the organization. Or it could raise the funds to build what Brockman calls a giant computer, but compromise its overarching mission by surrendering it to the financial incentives of its investors. To get around the impasse, the OpenAI founders devised a new structure for the organization, one with little precedent in the tech world. In March 2019, Brockman announced in a blog post the formation of OpenAI LP, a new for-profit entity that at first glance looked like a traditional venture-backed startup, the top-tier Silicon Valley fund Khosla Ventures was one of the lead investors, followed a few months later by Microsoft. But a closer look revealed that the new OpenAI had a novel structure, which the organization called a capped profit model. Investors could expect a return on the money they put in to support the building of the giant computer, but those returns would have a built-in ceiling. For initial funders, the ceiling was 100 times their original investment. By comparison, early funders of companies like Google or Facebook ultimately saw gains that were more than 1,000 times their initial investment. Any additional profits generated would be returned to the nonprofit entity to support its mission. And crucially, the privately funded part of the organization was legally subservient to the nonprofit. Every investment document began with a warning label at the top that read, "The partnership exists to advance OpenAI Inc.'s mission of ensuring that safe artificial general intelligence is developed and benefits all of humanity. The general partner's duty to this mission and the principles advanced in the OpenAI Inc. charter take precedence over any obligation to generate a profit." Skeptics were quick to dismiss these safeguards as just another more convoluted version of Don't Be Evil. With marquee venture funds pouring money into the organization and a new strategic partner in Microsoft, which would go on to help build the Iowa supercomputer, it was easy to see the OpenAI narrative as a well-intentioned but inevitable reversion to the corporate mean. Brockman and Sutzkever's opening manifesto declared that developing AI in a way that was beneficial to all of humanity was best left unconstrained by a need to generate financial return. And yet here they were, 3 years later, selling shares to blue-chip investors, talking about the potential for a 100-fold return on their money. OpenAI drew criticism for another tactic it adopted during this period, blocking all outside access to GPT-2, the large language model that preceded GPT-3, for 6 months on the grounds that the software was too dangerous for public use. By the launch of GPT-3 itself, the organization shifted to a less restrictive approach, allowing outside developers access after they had been reviewed by the organization's safety and alignment teams. But even that more inclusive model seemed a betrayal of the open source ethos that shaped the founding of the organization. Critics assumed this was yet another sign of the organization's shifting toward a closed source proprietary model in the style of its new partner, Microsoft. When we released GPT-3, Sam Altman told me over lunch at a restaurant off the Embarcadero in San Francisco, "We took a lot of flack from the community for putting it behind the API, that is, an application programming interface that only certain people were granted access to. Rather than do it the way the research community normally does, which is to say, here's the model, do whatever you want. But that is a one-way door. Once you put that thing out in the world, that's that." Altman argues that the slow rollout of GPT-3 is one way that OpenAI benefits from not having a traditional group of investors pushing for unlimited profit through the usual Silicon Valley approach of moving fast and breaking things. I think it lets us be more thoughtful and more deliberate about safety issues, Altman says. Part of our strategy is gradual change in the world is better than sudden change. Or as the OpenAI VP Mira Murati put it, when I asked her about the safety team's work restricting open access to the software, if we're going to learn how to deploy these powerful technologies, let's start when the stakes are very low. I'm only about halfway through that article, so I think I'm going to stop there and I'll finish it next week and read some of the smaller pieces from the magazine. And now I'll read on a lighter note, letter of recommendation. Rabbits are boring pets. I love them anyway. My friends and family don't get it. All I can do is try to describe what it's like to be with them, the moments I'm not sure I can do without. There's a dramatic close-up picture of a rabbit's head with a very dark eye and black fur. This is a story by Missouri Williams. Everyone who knew anything about animals warned me against getting a rabbit in my early 20s, but I ignored them and ended up with three. I inherited my first from a housemate and then found two online after moving to the Czech Republic. One came from a teenage girl with too many extracurricular activities. The other from an elderly man who lived at the top of a tower block on the outskirts of town. He had kept her for 3 years in a cage designed for pet rats, feeding her bird food and slices of brown bread. When I took her to the local vet, I was told that my rabbit had uterine cancer and a whole set of other health problems that needed treating at once. I duly shelled out the cash and spent the next couple of months nursing her back to health. Turns out that all the naysayers have a point. Rabbits get sick all the time, and there are very few vets who specialize in their care. They often have gut issues and fall victim to ear infections that can lead to torticollis, which is something I regret having seen. Don't search for it online. My years with rabbits have been a carousel of syringe feeding, panic trips to the vet, sleepless nights, and begging for advice on the internet. I've learned how to inject a rabbit with penicillin and how to massage an abdomen swollen from gas until something shifts. Now that my animals are old and arthritic, I mop up urine and clean their legs with a rabbit-friendly shampoo. I spend a lot of time on the floor because although my rabbits are socially demanding, they also hate to be picked up. As a rabbit owner, it can sometimes feel as if the world could be divided into two groups, people who are for rabbits and people who are against them. I often have the sense that my family and friends will be relieved when my two surviving rabbits finally pass away and stop taking up so much of my income and time. As my rabbits get older, they become increasingly expensive. My grandmother and the Uber drivers who take us to the vet ask me, why rabbits? Why not a dog or a cat, or if I have my heart set on something boring, a fish? My answers never satisfy anyone, but I'm not sure about the question either. It so often implies an instrumental sense of value, as if the correct reply might be, they make good companions, or they're nice to look at. I don't have the right kind of reason. My first rabbit just happened to be there. I got the second because I knew he needed a friend. My third rabbit was listed on a website selling second-hand items. She looked so unwanted and lonely that I thought I should help. In a world so full of disasters, who's going to pay any attention to one as little as hers? It's also the case that I like them, and that's never been anything I've wanted to quantify or enumerate. A few months back, an article about one woman's experience with her pet rabbits caused a lot of furor among the members of the House Rabbit Society group on Facebook. Though for the most part a place for bunny pictures, funny videos, memes, and amateur paintings, the group is serious in its commitment to rabbits and often prone to great stirrings. Its members disagreed with almost everything in the piece, especially with the way the writer seemed to suggest that her companions were valuable for the lessons they provided. In the final paragraph, she says that the point of small pets is to teach children about death, but they end up teaching her to fear mortality more generally. Among the members of the group where rabbits' lives are celebrated as inherently worthy and their deaths are treated as tragedies, both the article's central idea and flippant tone were met with severe disapproval. I don't believe in the use value of any living thing. Like humans, animals just are. That's it. When answering my grandmother's question, I try to describe what it's like to be with them, the moments I'm not sure I can do without, the sound of Pumpkin eating hay at 3 a.m, or of Hero thumping her back legs on the floor so loudly she almost gets us evicted, the apricot-colored fur on the back of Mr. Rabbit's neck, Pumpkin sleeping in a sunbeam, Hero growling at me as she eats, as if he thinks I'm going to take away her food, Mr. Rabbit binkying across the big carpet in our front room before surreptitiously ingesting one of its corners. How I never felt a real duty toward anything until I had my rabbits. At our best, we don't look at other people and think about how to make them work for us. Yet so much of our way of seeing the world is founded on the assumption that animals are meant to serve a purpose. They are ours, but we are not theirs. This seems wrong, but I can't pretend to have any answers to the catastrophe of our interspecies relations, and I can't recommend rabbits either. If I did, I'd be implying a use for them, when what I really think is that they are as useless as we are. After all these years with my trio, the only thing I know is that there's no reason to be learned or value to extract. There's just an effort to be made. And as far as I'm concerned, that's what living is. And I'll end with a letter to Judge John Hodgman on stupid dog names. Jim writes, "My fiancé and I have a dog named after my favorite baseball player, Jim Thom. I've heard it pronounced Tome or Tomy. When we're walking Tomy and a stranger asks his name, Kelly says it's Tommy, to avoid explaining a name she thinks is stupid. Please order her to call him Tomy." And the judge writes, "I feel bad for your hero, Jim Tomy. Kelly thinks his name sounds stupid, and you're not even sure how to pronounce it. It took me 5 minutes to find a clip of a young Tomy pleading to be heard. It's pronounced Tomy. By the way, Jim Tomy is a great name for a dog. It's less confusing than Tomy, which really does sound like a mispronunciation of Tommy. That said, you named him Tomy alone, and so he shall be called. But it will also be your job to explain his name. It seems like you're on these walks too. Speak up for Jim Tomy, both of them." Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.